And Judiciary come to order. Today is February 24th. The first item we're going to hear, we're going to go to the marijuana hearing first, and then we will go back to the work session on House Bill 1536 after that. On 1550, we will be running, have that hearing on that bill today. We are not going to be introducing any amendments on 1550, but people who had amendments are going to be able to come up and speak and get on the record with their concerns. Senators, if I could have you up first, open a work set or a public hearing on House Bill 1531A.
Mr. Barker, members of the committee, thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 1531. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, Senator from District 29. As originally introduced by Senator Monroe and myself, this bill was intended to empower local governments to make the best decisions for their communities. Unfortunately, the Senate removed some of those protections, leaving many cities and counties across Oregon vulnerable to expensive lawsuits and less able to protect their children. Today, I urge the committee to adopt the A7 amendments. The A7 amendments clarify that local governments can't opt out of having dispensaries, protecting our local parties from costly litigation. And the -A8 amendments protect our kids from being targeted with marijuana products, including THC lace, cotton candy, and gummy bears, for example. I believe these amendments are a responsible bipartisan solution to the challenge and issues in communities across Oregon, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Senator.
And I'm Rod Monroe, District 24. Happy to be here with my colleague, Senator Hansel. We're the co-sponsors of 1531, which we introduced at the bequest of the cities and counties who want to have local control over marijuana dispensaries. Local control means that they can decide whether they have marijuana dispensaries within their jurisdiction or whether those can meet certain regulations. It's going to be purely up to the cities and counties. I really believe that for many issues in our state, the cities and the counties are closer to the people than the state legislature or the governor, and are better able to determine what the specific needs are for their particular community. And it's not all the same. You know, what's good for inner Portland may not be good for Medford, and vice versa. And so we introduced this legislation. We thought it was good legislation the way it was introduced, but unfortunately we couldn't get it out of the Senate committee without major changes that really gut the bill. And so what we're doing today is asking you to fix it back to the way we introduced it in the first place, plus some additional guidelines to additional protections. So with that, my fellow legislators, Senator Bill and I would be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for the senators from anybody? Thank you very much for your testimony.
You bet. You have the amendments, right?
We do. Rob Bovet, Kevin Campbell, and Scott Winkles.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name for the record is Rob Ovette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll try to make it brief and get right to the point. First, just let me clarify what we're trying to do here, and in order to do that, I got to just spit out a few sentences. The first is, House Bill 3460 itself, in my opinion and the opinion of many of my colleagues, does not in fact preempt local authority to ban or regulate. However, it is my opinion and shared with a number of my colleagues that Senate Bill 863 from your special session does in fact on its face attempt to preempt local authority to ban or regulate dispensaries. That's the GMO bill. However, as a third layer, we also believe that it is more likely than not that federal law trumps that preemption. But the bottom line is we're going to wind up litigating that issue because of the ambiguity created by the GMO bill. We think ultimately we'll survive and win that litigation, but it's going to take years and it's going to be very expensive. So the purpose of this bill, Senate Bill 1531, is to clarify that quite literally, notwithstanding the GMO bill, we recognize that local authority has the ability to regulate and or opt out. That's how the bill started. As the good senator mentioned, they stripped out the clarification of the opt-out, and our Dash 7 amendments propose to add that back. The Dash 8 amendments takes care of just one small issue with the medical marijuana dispensary program. As I provided to you in my written testimony, there are a lot of deficiencies in our program. In my opinion, we'll be rolling out next month the most unregulated dispensary program in the nation. The deficiencies I pointed out is a 10-point bullet list. I think it's quite staggering what we're not regulating when it comes to dispensaries. I'm not proposing to fix all of those things. I probably will come back to you in 2015 with some fixes to try to at least patch up some of this lack of regulation. However, many of your colleagues have asked me to address one small issue. Well, I don't think it's so small, but one significant issue that we would like to address before this thing rolls out, and that's giving OHA, the Oregon Health Authority, the power to regulate some of these THC-infused products that are effectively marketed to kids. We've seen this happen in other states, and right now we don't have any rules, we don't have any authority to address that issue. So the Dash A8 amendments give OHA that authority. One of the things, and I'll just close with this, one of the things that was mentioned in the Senate side kind of repeatedly was, well, we don't allow local authorities to regulate pharmacies. Why are we doing that with dispensaries? And my answer is, we're not rolling out pharmacies next month. Pharmacies are highly regulated at both the federal and a state level. This is not highly regulated by any stretch of the imagination. Both cities and counties in Washington and California have authority to opt out and or regulate, and that's what we're asking for here, that we get clarity and that we not have to litigate that issue. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bovet?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Bovet. So it sounds like there was, regarding Senate Bill 863 from the 2013 special session GMO, it sounds like there's a federal statute that implicates that one way or the other. And is that particular to, for instance, a right to farm type of context, or are you talking about local control?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, actually it's the Controlled Substances Act. So this is specific to marijuana. We have a set of case law both evolving here and in other states that talk about when marijuana programs in any state are in conflict with the Controlled Substances Act. And we have a body of case law that tells us when it's not in conflict and when it is in conflict. For example, the affirmative defenses in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act are definitely not in conflict because all they purport to do is exempt people from criminal prosecution under state law. No conflict. But when you're essentially compelling, for example, or trying to compel a city to issue a business license to commit a federal crime, that's a conflict. And we suspect that Oregon courts will say that's a conflict. Okay. So this Controlled Substances Act would, after litigation, essentially preempt 863 as applied to dispensaries.
Thank you.
Right, Mr. Taylor. Mr.
Chairman of the committee, in the material that you have for this meeting is a letter dated February 5th, 2014 to Senator Prezansky. It's an opinion from Legislative Counsel's office. And what they say, we conclude that RS 475-314 preempts most municipal laws specifically targeting medical marijuana facilities. We further conclude that while a municipality may not be required to violate federal law to comply with a conflicting state law, a municipality may not act contrary to state law merely because the municipality believes that the action will better carry out the purposes and objectives of federal law. So we do have an opinion on that. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, if I could address one question to Rob, if I could. I have the A7 amendments in front of me. I assume everyone else does, too. In line 5, it says, prohibits the establishment of medical marijuana facilities in the area subject to the jurisdiction of the city or county. Now, my assumption is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that I believe the intent there, as I talked to the Legislative Council's office, is, for example, if Marion County were to say no medical marijuana facilities, that would apply to Marion County, but not to the city of Salem.
Correct. Right. That is correct. And Mr. Chair, Council Taylor, I agree. That's basically the way the current law is. To address the Legislative Council opinion, it's the latest in a series of Legislative Council opinions, which I actually don't disagree with. They have said that either 3460 and or 863 likely on its face preempts local authority. I agree that 863 does on its face preempt local authority. And that's what we're seeking clarification of, so we don't have to litigate that.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. Taking us back to the days prior to 3460's passage of the dispensary bills, we had a scenario where there were about, depending on who you asked, 150 to 200 dispensaries operating within the state of Oregon. And there was no regulation, there was no notification to local governments. The League of Oregon Cities thought creating a system where they would have, these dispensaries would have to register, the cities would have to know about them, was a positive for cities. But what that bill did not do, and those words simply were not in the statute, was preempt local control. We had been very clear on that in meetings with stakeholders and in our floor letter supporting the bill. We pointed out that the bill was not preemptive on local control. I don't think there was never any stated intent on the legislative record that said that we wished that 3460 should preempt the ability of the city council to either opt out or issue their own regulations. Moving forward, we have the special session, and that created a scenario where we believe cities would prevail were they to go to court due to the federal preemption on the CSA. But it could create a scenario where cities would be forced to go into protracted litigation that would be expensive. And I don't think anybody here would know for certain as to what the courts would do with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and to what degree the federal government does, in fact, the CSA would preempt the state's involvement in the distribution of marijuana. I think that not knowing is a concern to us. We think providing this clarity is very important for all parties involved. Cities across the state have responded differently to 3460 and the dispensaries. As you're aware, we've had several cities that have prohibited them. There are some cities that have allowed them, and some cities have taken the wait a minute approach, where their stated intent is to ban for now and then spend some time and think about it and whether or not this is something they would like to do or what regulatory package would be appropriate for their jurisdictions, and maybe take some time to look at what's happening in other states and other communities that have allowed dispensaries. The bill 1531, as written and as we would urge this committee to amend, would give cities that ability to take that time without threat of litigation and come up with their own regulations and figure out for themselves that this is something that they would like to do. With that, I'm open for your questions.
Mr. Campbell.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1531 with the dash A7 and A8 amendments. I was going to say that we submitted a joint letter of testimony in favor of the bill, but that didn't sound right, so I'll say combined letter at this point. I knew we had to lighten it up just a little bit, but Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I share and agree with the comments that have already been made by Mr. Bovet and Mr. Winkles. I'd add that obviously local governments around the state are each taking this issue very seriously, and that's why you're seeing decisions that reflect, frankly, community values. And it's the elected officials there on the ground that are having to struggle through this decision for the community members that they serve. The police chiefs, for their part, are advisors. They play a role in helping elected decision makers make these decisions. And I think you've seen a variety of decisions made. This bill does clarify, I think, properly authority for local governments to make these decisions. And I'd encourage the committee, based on that, to adopt the dash A7 and dash 8 amendments to this bill and to support Senate Bill 1531. So with that, I thank the committee, and we'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Campbell. Representative Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure to whom this should go, but I'm hearing a lot of issues about local control, and I'm certainly supportive of local control. So in my community, one of the big issues is strip clubs. And so my understanding is there isn't a lot of local control about strip clubs where a lot of alcohol is served. Can you give me any feedback how that would compare with the local control over the distribution of a medicine that Oregonians have said they want people to take, right?
Mr. Taylor can maybe answer.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Tomei, we have very robust forebears in Oregon on Article 1, Section 8. And when you're talking strip clubs, you're talking about the expression of free speech. Therefore, it's constitutionally protected. I don't think anyone has argued that dispensary of drugs or marijuana is constitutionally protected. So that would be the distinction. I think the appropriate analogy would be the pharmacy. Basically, what we've said, where we allow entertainment in an area, we don't regulate the content. That's probably what the, as good a scenario as I can give you right now.
Thank you.
Yes.
If I may, though, the serving of alcohol within those establishments is strictly regulated by the OLCC, and the people who are serving that alcohol have to go through training and have those permits, and is under review by local authorities if there's problems for the liquor license. So that's an issue that would be similar.
The freedom of speech has to do with where they can locate is the where they can be prohibited from locating. It's a speech. So that's the issue there. Representative Hicks.
Yes, sir. Actually, and to pick up on that point, my understanding of the OLCC regulations is that jurisdictions have the option of even going dry regarding alcohol, even now. And so I think there is some precedent there in regards to the alcohol laws in terms of what these amendments would be proposing.
Okay, thank you.
Could I ask a further question?
Yes, you can.
Then maybe Representative Hicks can answer this. So how many jurisdictions are dry in that sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, I can answer that because I'm a graduate of Western Oregon State.
I went to the police academy there.
So. Monmouth was the last dry town in Oregon, and it went wet maybe 15 years ago, long after I graduated. But to be serious for a moment, I think and I don't want to equate medical marijuana establishments to bars, because I get your point, Representative Tomei, but it does illustrate part of the concern local governments would have is that if there is a problem bar, the cities have to rely on the state to act on that license. Cities don't have that authority. And with respect, there has been significant conflict and in some cases profound disappointment on the part of local governments in closing down problem establishments.
Oh, yeah.
And to ask cities to say that we are preempted and cannot prohibit these establishments and that we could not close them down is one more thing the state where we would have tied a local government's hand. I mean, the state isn't the one that's going to have to respond to problems at the establishment. The state, if there's a conflict with the neighbor, that's going to be a city requirement. It'll be a city obligation to respond to.
Can I add, Mr. Chair, just briefly, to the point that Representative Cameron was making and your point, Representative Tomei, I think if you look at my punch list of 10 things that we're not regulating with dispensaries, if you look at number 2, and a good point, my daughter, who has an OLCC server's permit, can pour you a glass of wine where she works, and if she pours it to you when you're clearly intoxicated or you're underage, there's something we can do about that. The people that are actually working in these dispensaries will be unlicensed and unregulated. That's one of the things that 3460 and the entire regulatory scheme that we're rolling out next month doesn't do at all.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Cindy Robert and Doug Riggs, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the city of Medford. You actually have a letter from my police chief that I sent to you last week. But I wanted to just take this opportunity to really let you know strongly that we understand we're one of the first cities to come out and make a statement and say we don't want dispensaries in our area. We made a statement that said if it's against the law, either local or state or federal, we don't want it to have a business front in our area. Now, why do we do this? Well, because we really believe Southern Oregon is different. We really believe our city is different. And we hope that the body will respect the fact that all the cities are different. We have a 6-month outdoor grow cycle in Southern Oregon. We have a lot bigger crops, a lot more people growing, which would mean if dispensaries could be anywhere they wanted, we would have more dispensaries per person in Southern Oregon than anywhere in our state. As a matter of fact, we have 7,200 medical marijuana cardholders in Jackson County alone. That's one card for every 28 citizens. We have a lot of local law enforcement issues that we have to deal with. Medical marijuana dispensaries do not come with more money for our police force. We can't handle any more of the issues than we already do, and we truly believe that dispensaries will make us have more criminal activity. So we hope that you will respect our ability to make that decision and our citizens' agreement that we should be making that decision as well.
Thank you. Mr. Riggs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs, I'm here on behalf of the Central Oregon cities, which are Redmond, Bryanville, Madras, Metolius, Culver, and Maupin and Sisters. We have been very interested in the subject for quite a while, and I think it really boils down to a local control issue. I've passed out a letter from the city of Redmond, but I think my other cities agree. Many of them have had requirements on books requiring that businesses comply both with state and federal regulations. Redmond's has been on the books since 1989. This boils down to us as a local control issue. Locally elected officials, city council members will convene panels, work with their community, and try to decide what the best approach is for that particular community. So a one-size-fits-all approach in this particular case at this time doesn't make a lot of sense. And I just echo the comments from the first panel. There's quite a bit of confusion based on the bill that passed out of the special session. We believe that the bill, the underlying bill, the Dash 7s, help clarify that. We're strongly supportive of the Dash 8s to try to keep those types of products off of shelves, out of communities, and away from children. So fully supportive of the Dash 7s and the 8s.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Riggs? Thank you, panel. Anthony Taylor, John Sand, and Anthony Johnson, please.
Is that John Sejo?
Yes, it is. Looked like an N there and a D. You go in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Well, I'll go first then. My name is Anthony Taylor. I'm the director of Compassionate Oregon, Political Action Committee dedicated to protecting the rights of the patients under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. I would like to encourage the committee to please remember that this bill is for the patients. In Yamhill County, we have over 1,000 patients, and Yamhill County just implemented a moratorium. So now all those people have to go someplace else to find their medication. And as I get older, more and more of my friends are coming down with cancer and are finding good therapeutic benefit from the use of cannabis to treat their nausea, to enhance their appetite, and to, you know, take some of the pain away from the chemotherapies. And this bill was targeted at those people because you walk into the doctor's office with a pain in your hip, and the next time you see the doctor, he says you're in stage two. Now you got, if you want to take advantage of the therapeutic benefits of cannabis, you got to go find some. You got to get your card, you got to go find some. And for a lot of these patients that are my age and older, they don't have the skill set to go out and obtain this medicine. So the dispensaries provide this avenue for them to get that medicine. I would also like to take issue with Bavette's statement that this isn't a very well-regulated program. As I went through the rules, and I'm just going to hold these up really quickly, the blue represents what's required by the dispensary owner. The pink is what's required by the OHA. Blue and pink. Blue and pink. Blue and pink. blue and pink, some yellow, blue and pink. This is one of the most heavily regulated programs I've seen in a long time. And I would remind the committee that it is under the supervision of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, which we haven't had really too many problems with yet. So I would encourage the committee not to adopt the amendments, put this through, put it out to the House for a vote, and let's get it on the governor's desk, because there's too many patients out there that are unable to come up with the medication they need. One more minute here. Also, this thing about the infused products, it's one of the delivery methods that people that have, you know, breathing conditions and things like that take advantage of, because they don't want to take the smoke into their system, so they have some edibles. Now, could we look at it and talk about the gummy bears and the gummy worms and the pot corn and the pot tarts and all that? Sure, but I don't think we should let it preclude us from implementing this statute. And if the cities want to regulate that sort of thing, then let them regulate it. But to ask that, to allow them to outright ban this, these facilities and this access to medication that many of these patients are unable to get in any other way, I think is short-sighted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony Johnson. Today I represent the Oregon Cannabis Industry Association, who is working to implement good cannabis laws for the industry, as well as all of Oregonians. Chair Barker, members of this committee, thank you for listening to us today. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 1531 as written without amendments. You know, members of the cannabis community, either patients or in the industry, also share many of the concerns of law enforcement and the counties. We want rules and regulations that fit our neighborhoods. We want to keep marijuana out of the hands of children. We want safe highways and roads, and we want safe neighborhoods. And all the evidence from medical marijuana states and states with medical cannabis facilities shows that there is not a huge increase in teen use. Traffic fatalities do not increase on our roads. And medical marijuana facilities do not attract crime. They are actually safer than banks. And they're very comparable to coffee shops and pharmacies as far as attracting any additional crime. And I will email the committee with stats and statistics and studies that demonstrate all this as a follow-up. And those of us within the industry that look forward to a day where cannabis prohibition for adults has ended, we understand that a well-regulated system is very important. If it's the Wild West and there are all kinds of problems, there's only going to be voter backlash against ending cannabis prohibition for all adults. And sensible rules and regulations are the answer to that. Further prohibition is only going to push patients underground and put them in danger and push the problems into other communities. Marijuana prohibition, like alcohol cannabis prohibition before it, funds underground markets and criminals. And to force patients into those neighborhoods or into those criminal elements because of where they happen to live, I think it's unfair for those patients. If you want to look at opting out and having local control, I urge you to look at the alcohol statutes for opting out. The alcohol statutes require a public vote. It cannot be done by just, you know, three members of a county commission. So if we want to go that route, I urge that route. I think that in this short session, passing sensible rules and regulations is the way to go. Monitor the program, and let's come back next session and see if any additional rules and regulations are needed. But I'm afraid further prohibition will only exacerbate the problems in our communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
My name is John Sager. I'm the director of the Voter Power Foundation. We've advocated for medical marijuana since before the 1998 initiative, and I was the author of both of the dispensary initiatives that were on the ballot. I would, like my colleagues here, would urge you to support the bill and oppose the amendments. I think the idea that banning dispensaries makes them go away or makes the dispensing go away is simply wrong. It's an illusion. The sick people are still there. The patients that benefit from medical marijuana are still there. And if they need the medicine and can benefit from it, then you're going to force them to deal with the much harder elements of this system of finding a grower and a caregiver. And if they can't do that, dealing with the black market. And I've been working with patients for 15 years on this law. And banning dispensaries is going to hurt the sickest patients. It's going to hurt the poorest patients. It's going to hurt the patients that are on their deathbed. The patients that you think are faking it to get high, it's not going to touch them. I think like all prohibition, you don't gain control by prohibiting or banning. You lose control. And frankly, I think it's a distraction from the discussion we ought to have, which is how to perfect this law, which is a good first effort at regulating dispensaries, but has a lot of flaws. But I don't think the ban addresses any of that. I share some of Rob Bovet's concerns about this law. I think, for example, here's a law that has regulation in the form of a background check. But what do you look for? You look for whether somebody's been convicted of growing or selling marijuana. So one of my colleagues, for example, who has a felony on her record now, because as a patient she mailed some medicine to herself and got convicted for it, she could never run a dispensary. But a serial killer who's been convicted of murder several times could run a dispensary. So that's a crazy law to me, that you can be a murderer or a child molester or somebody that's committed fraud and you can run a dispensary. But if you happen to be a patient that grew a little too much marijuana a while ago, you can't. It doesn't make any sense. It also doesn't make any sense to apply the background check to only one person at each dispensary. I share that. Why, you know, maybe there's some reasonable ground for licensing and training of the people that are dispensing this important medication. This bill doesn't address that. Right now, there's nothing in the bill that, there's no transparency of ownership. The Mexican cartel or the president of North Korea or Walmart could secretly own and operate in a dispensary in Oregon, and none of us would ever know it. I think there's improvements in that area could be made. The testing right now, the way it's set up, is a big boondoggle. You're going to make a lot of money for people in the testing business, but there's nobody testing the testers. But you're requiring all this medicine to go through this, very elaborate, complicated system, but I don't think it addresses the problems that a lot of us would find to be common ground. So I would encourage you to reject these amendments. Banning dispensaries or putting off dealing with figuring out how to deal with them is the wrong approach. What we should be doing is getting the people from the cities and the counties together with advocates like myself and law enforcement and patients and figuring out where the common ground is, what the problems are, and how we can move forward. I think most of us want to have the good operators running these things and not the bad ones. And right now, there's a lot of these regulations don't do that. So I would encourage you to form a work group where people like Rob Bovet sit down with people like me and my colleagues and some of you legislators and people from the treatment industry, whoever you want to put in there. But we need to talk about this and find the way to have appropriate regulation that serves all the interests of the community. But, cities banning dispensaries, for one thing, the idea that they're going to avoid litigation is crazy, and any money they save in litigation, they're going to lose in law enforcement from police being forced to arrest people that are trying to help the sick and most vulnerable patients in our society. That's not a good way to spend our money, and I don't think you'll save a penny by banning dispensaries or putting off the day when we figure out how to deal with them. So that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony. I have Chris Oss. He was down in Overflow. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
No problem. My name is Christopher Justin Oss. Really don't have anything prepared for you today. I really didn't think that this would even be a consideration after it being unanimously passed the other day. And just kind of off the wall comment, I think it's kind of funny that Bovet has so much opposition to a bill he helped create. And also how alcohol is even being considered when we're talking about medicine. I mean, is there a city in Oregon that pharmacies are banned? Because if so, I'd like to know where it's at. I don't think you'd make your grandmother drive 150 miles, 50 miles, 20 miles even, to get Oxycontin or even antibiotics, but we're talking about marijuana, medical marijuana here. I mean, we have whole industries, Salem Cannabis and Industry Association. I mean, you're talking about 100, 150 jobs just in Salem alone. I mean, statewide, you consider you about half the counties ban it. You're talking thousands and thousands of jobs, not even the, you know, that's just dispensaries. That's not even grow shops, you know, places that support the growing of the medical marijuana. I just find it really obtrusive that alcohol is even being considered to compare to it in the regulations thereof. But anyways, I own a place right down the street in unincorporated Marion County. I talked to the county the other day. We had a meeting. We came to some agreements on how it would run, where I can be, all that kind of thing. Daycares we implemented, which wasn't in there. After the meeting was over, I actually called Gloria Roy back and asked her to amend additional regulations on me, that I can only be open so late, that there can only be so many per capita in my area. So I really don't think full-on banning is a good idea. I believe that reasonable talks with counties and cities is a better option than just not even considering having it there and making my grandmother go to the skate park to get drugs from a crackhead. I mean, that makes no sense. So that's all I really have to say. I just find this completely ridiculous with only a few days till we get our permits. I've spent thousands upon thousands of dollars conforming to these cameras, which only banks and casinos have. I mean, we put all this in. We put the panic alarms in, which only banks and, you know, some government. I mean, you may have them here. But, I mean, we've conformed fully. And with only a few days left, it seems completely irrational that we're even here considering this. We've conformed to your laws. I've asked my county for extra regulations and what they wanted to impose on me. I mean, I think we can figure this out at a local level instead of full-on banning it. Thank you.
Thank you. And just, this doesn't require them to ban it. It would allow it. So
was that?
It does not require banning of the...
Well, allowing. Marion County already said they'd ban me if they had the option. I fought for that. And extra regulations. Half of Southern Oregon would full-out ban if given the option. I mean, you're talking about half the state guaranteed banning.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Austin.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll go to a work session on Senate Bill 1531A.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A7 amendments to House Bill, Senate Bill 1531.
Representative Barton moves the dash 7 amendments into Senate Bill 1531A. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, from the proponents and opponents of this amendment, there's a lot of passion on both sides. This is not really an issue of moral conviction for me, as it is for some. I really am just, as I sit here, I'm trying to do what I think my constituents would like me to do. Unfortunately, I think our voters have sent us very mixed messages on what to do. They enact medical marijuana policy. It appears to be very popular, as best I can tell. The 2005 legislature expands the number of plants that can be grown, and I think for up to 4 people. And then at the same time, the people of Oregon have rejected at least once, I think twice, dispensary system. And when you throw them all together, there's no real way. I don't know what to do. Anyway, and so that is something where I think we as a people and an assembly will be wrestling with for a long time. I'm sorry. It's going to be messy. And I'm doing my best, but I think that my constituents would like me to support the A7 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any objections to the amendments, to the amendment? Hearing none, A7 is in.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash the A8 amendment to Senate Bill 1531.
Representative Barton moves the dash 8 into Senate Bill 1531. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1531 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves the Senate Bill 1531A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Hicks,
Mr. Chair,
discussion.
If there is a conference committee on this, ultimately, I'd like to volunteer to participate.
Okay, thank you. And I would expect that there will be, we'll see.
We'll see.
If it doesn't. If the
I'd also like to volunteer Representative Olson to participate on that.
If it does pass the House, it goes to conference committee. I will ask that you both be on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you go ahead and call the roll, please?
Representative Cameron.
I deny the nomination.
Aye.
Representative Hicks.
Aye.
Representative Leininger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Excused.
Representative Williamson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Olson.
Representative Olson, do you want to carry this on the floor?
Oh, sure.
Okay. I will have questions.
Representative Olson will be a carrier. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1536. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 1536 comes here from the Judicial Department. You may remember last week on the 20th, we had a hearing on this bill, and in work session, we adopted the 8-4 amendments. The reason we did not move the bill at the time, we did not have the FSRA statement. We now do have that. The bill relates to dependency and what information can be disclosed, and it also relates to adoption and what information can be disclosed here, Mr. Chair, House Committee. So and the fiscal is minimal.
Okay, so it's ready to go.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Warren Wirtz, would you like a motion?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1536 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 1536 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I can carry them.
And Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Thank you. Next, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1550.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1550 comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. You may remember this issue from last session. The generic term of speedy trial requires that a trial must be commenced within 2 years from the date of the filing of the charging instrument if most serious offense is an instrument is a misdemeanor. In 3 years, the most serious offense is a charging instrument is a felony. There are various exclusions from that and exemptions, and also certain activities that will cause that period of time to toll for a bit. Chair, members of the committee, the amendments that I know of, we have the dash A10 and the A13. The A10 prohibit persons convicted of attempted rape in the first degree, attempted sodomy in the first degree, attempted unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and sexual abuse first degree from relief from the sex offender registration. The dash 13 amendment, Mr. A13 amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, which supplant the A11, that was a technical problem with the A11s. Start the period beginning from the date of arraignment must be commenced from the period of time identical to the statute of limitations, exclude from time limitations period of time during which law enforcement was unable to apprehend the defendant despite using reasonable efforts, requires court to consider statutory and constitutional rights of the victim, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. And for the audience, I do not plan to have any amendments added to this today, but we have people who had the who supported the amendments. I want them to be able to speak and put it on the record. And first, I will ask Aaron Knott from DOJ just to come up and give us a thumbnail of the bill, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may, allow me to just note, this is a perfect example why we should never have bills relating to crime. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With the broad relating to crime. Yeah, absolutely correct. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General and the Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 1550A. First of all, to clarify, my testimony is directed towards 1550A. My written testimony makes reference to 1550A-8. That's the amendment that was integrated by the Senate, but I'm testifying just 1550A, not amended. For most of you, this is not a new issue. Statutory speedy trial came before you last year via House Bill 2962, sponsored by the representative from Josephine County. That bill was passed out of the House, went over to the Senate, and there was given a one-year sunset and instructions to get to work to try and come up with some fixes for a statutory speedy trial regime in Oregon that pretty much everybody agreed was not working well. So we got to work about 8 months ago, a lot of negotiation, and this was the product. We were really aiming at three discrete problems, and I think 1550A gets at all three of them. First of all, pre-arraignment delay. This is something that you may remember hearing about. Basically, last year there was a lot of testimony on 2962 about just how thin the coverage in some areas of the state has become for law enforcement generally, but particularly for the service of warrants. You're talking about areas sometimes the size of more or less Rhode Island, to make a reference to Josephine County, where you have only one sheriff on duty. And under existing law, statutory speedy trial, which causes a case to be dismissed without prejudice, meaning it can be refiled, but can kick in as little as a year. And the feeling was that just was not realistic for some of these counties, that we were asking the impossible. The second problem was judicial delay, which is being experienced in a number of other counties, which is basically when you show up, the state's ready, the defendant is ready, the victim is ready, everybody's paid for their witnesses, and there is no judge, usually because, again, of resource problems. So the case is set over, even though nobody wants that. Finally, Oregon is the only state in the union, to my knowledge, and I've looked at the statutory speedy trial regimes of all 50 states, that uses the term reasonable. Right now, our speedy trial statute basically says that a defendant must be brought to trial within a reasonable amount of time. From that one word, reasonable, many problems have followed. The Department of Justice became involved originally because we are spending so much taxpayer money on litigating what that word means. And it's not just us. It's the trial courts. It's the Court of Appeals. And you find that virtually every other state that has a statutory speedy trial regime, and there are 48 of them, imposes some sort of a bright line. The nature of that bright line varies, but it was clear to us when we looked at the statute that it was just good practice to try and come up with a rule rather than arguing indefinitely about what reasonability means. So before I go into what this does, I want to make it clear again, because this comes up repeatedly. This is not constitutional speedy trial. Statutory speedy trial and constitutional speedy trial aren't the same. Constitutional speedy trial is a right that a defendant has to be brought to trial within a reasonable is not the right word, but within an amount of time that doesn't cause prejudice to them. Prejudice meaning that they suffer an adverse effect, the loss of a witness, the loss of physical evidence, the time is manifestly unreasonable, which is different than what we mean in the statute. Statutory speedy trial is just a mechanism for the court to keep their dockets moving along. It sort of allows the judge to say to the parties, okay, it's time. Put up or shut up. You've got to go now. So that's where this all came from. Just to give a very brief overview of what this does, Senate Bill 1550A replaces the current reasonability with a two-year period in which statutory speedy trial does not apply. It's basically you get 2 years for a misdemeanor and 3 years for a felony. That baseline period is subject to a range of deductions, and most of these are brought out of case law or were very common to other states and include some very obvious things. For example, if a defendant fails to appear, clearly that time won't count against the state. They're found unable to aid and assist. If we know that they're in another jurisdiction, but we're unable to obtain their presence. If we can't locate them, but we've made a due diligent effort to locate them, none of those times count. So it sets up those baselines. If you get beyond that, if the state still hasn't brought somebody to trial within those periods, it's dismissed, the charges are dismissed without prejudice. Now that means if you're over the statute of limitations, which not coincidentally is 2 years for most misdemeanors and 3 years for most felonies, you cannot reindict the case or reissue the information. At that point, it's over. For your more serious offenses or certain special crimes, like sex crimes is one that often has a longer period, murder has no statute of limitations, the prosecution is free to reissue the case. That's the exact same remedy that they have now, so that aspect of the law hasn't changed. If at the end of this process, once you've gone through everything, there isn't a guideline that applies, there's a catch-all that basically says, and this is in Section 3 on the third page, if all else fails, to paraphrase, the charging instrument will not be dismissed if the court finds on the record substantial and compelling reasons to allow the proceeding to continue. That sort of catch-all phrase is recommended by the ABA, the American Bar Association, just to provide some last line for exceptional circumstances. And I think here it'll allow the statute to be flexible, it'll allow the statute to be versatile. This won't catch every instance of statutory speedy trial, and I submit to you that it shouldn't. Our goal here was to make a compromise. It was not to eliminate statutory speedy trial completely. That was the discussion we had last year, and we went away from that. What this does is provide the courts, provide the prosecution, and provide law enforcement with some heretofore lacking standards about what they need to do to get in under the line. It'll save the state of Portland money, and it'll provide a great measure of appellate clarity. I urge your passage of 1550A, and I am open for any questions.
Any questions? Representative Williamson, please.
Aaron, when you were in the work group, you looked at other state statutes. How does this compromise compare to those?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I looked at all 50 states, the ABA, and the federal system. I don't recommend that to anyone. And if I had to make that characterization, I would say that this is on the law enforcement friendly side in terms of time duration. You see a lot of states with down to as little as 6 months, up to 180 days. There are two states that do not have statutory speedy trial. There are a couple that are longer under some circumstances, but I think I can say confidently that this would be in the top 10% or so.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Knott.
Thank you.
Jeff Howes, Josh Marquis, and Dana, please. Okay. Go in any order. Please remember to identify yourself for the records.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vitolins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney and also here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And we are here essentially today to object to Anne Gross 1550, Senate Bill 1550. And before I get into my reasons for, and those are essentially two, I would like to correct a misimpression that I have heard regularly over the past week, and that is that the Oregon District Attorneys Association did not engage in the process to work on the speedy trial statute. We actually were part of the process, surprisingly enough. I met with Senator, over the last year, I met with Senator Przanski, Representative Hicks, Bill Taylor. I also met with Gail Myers and Aaron Knott to try to come to an agreement. We were simply unable to agree as on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Essentially, we have several reasons why we object to Anne Gross 15, Senate Bill 1550 as it relates to statutory speedy trial, because there is a section that deals with reserve police officers, so our objections are only to the speedy trial portion. I will talk about two of those issues and then turn it over to Jeff Howes, who's here from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, to talk about the remaining issues. First of all, Section 2 refers to time that is excluded, as Mr. Knott talked about, from the time on the 2 and 3 year limit. Section H excludes the time when defendants request a continuance of the trial. That is a problem for many counties because trial is not set at the time of arraignment like it is in Multnomah County. For instance, in Crook County, we schedule a pretrial conference after arraignment and then set the trial after one or more pretrial conferences. Defense attorneys in Crook County regularly request continuances, sometimes three or more, before a trial is scheduled. That delay is not excluded here. The counties where a pretrial or status occurs before the trial is scheduled are Benton, Clackamas, Clatsop, Columbia, Crook, Deschutes, Harney, Hood River, Jackson, Josephine, Lake, Lane, Lincoln, Polk, Malheur, Morrow, Sherman, Tillamook, Umatilla, Washington, and Yamhill. The second issue is that judicial delay due to lack of resources is also not excluded and is, in fact, counted, according to the case law, counted against the prosecution. We as prosecutors simply have no control over judicial delay due to lack of resources. In Crook County, we have one jury courtroom for all of our criminal trials, so cases are regularly bumped due to lack of resources. And the counties where judicial delay due to lack of resources is a factor are Benton, Clackamas, Clatsop, Crook, Columbia, Deschutes, Harney, Hood River, Grant, Josephine, Lincoln, Lynn, Malheur, Morrow, Polk, Tillamook, Umatilla, Wasco, and Washington. Those are where judicial delay due to lack of resources is a regular factor. In Jackson County, it occasionally comes as an issue. I have nothing further unless you have any questions. We'll ask that it be turned over to Deputy DA Jeff House.
Thank you. Mr. House.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Jeff House, and I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I'm testifying here today on behalf of both my office and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I want to limit my comments basically to the Dash 13 amendment, specifically the provision that is in the Dash 13, which changes the limitation in the A engrossed, the 1550A engrossed, from 2 years on misdemeanors and 3 years on felonies to tying it to the statute of limitations for those crimes. Now, for 90% plus of the crimes on the books, the statute of limitations is just that, 2 years on misdemeanors and 3 years on felonies. For felonies, I referenced the sentencing guidelines grid, which is our go-to grid. It talks about every felony and how it's going to be sentenced. But I did that in order to look at how many felonies are on there and which ones would be affected by tying the dismissal of a case for lack of speedy trial, statutory speedy trial, to the statute of limitations. There's a 182 crimes listed on this grid. Of those, 26 would be affected. Their dismissal date, outer dismissal date, would be extended if this were tied to the statute of limitations as opposed to the bright line 3-year rule. I want to give you, I'm not going to read them all 26, but I'll tell you in general which ones they are. Any category of murder or manslaughter, all of the first degree sex crimes, rape, sodomy, sex pen, sex abuse, the second degrees, rape 2, sodomy 2, unlawful sex pen 2, the crimes of strangulation, criminal mistreatment, rape 3, sodomy 3. I think you get the picture. They're the most serious crimes with which we deal, and we deal with them every day. My friend Mr. Knott testified, and I said this in front of Senate Judiciary when I had a very brief opportunity to address them, that great work went into this. Hard work and good work by both sides went into this. And I offered up to Chair Przanski at that point that I had a couple of suggestions that I thought would make it even better. And I was told by Chair Przanski at that hearing, that work session, that we would have the opportunity to do so over on the House side. Unfortunately, it appears that may not be true, but I'm here to speak about it anyway, and I appreciate Chair Barker the opportunity to do that. The idea that, and it gets tossed around a lot, members of the committee, that the state can just refile on these cases, that's, to use a cliche, easier said than done. I had a case that I've used as an example a couple of different times when discussing this, an aggravated murder case. It was a cold case. It happened in 1991. By the time we zeroed in on a suspect, it was 2001. And that's a different issue. If we're talking about speedy trial, that would be a pre-indictment delay or constitutional speedy trial. But that case involved 40 witnesses to get indicted, 40 witnesses, including one from California and one from Helsinki, Finland. Now, to say that after 3 years, if we just sat on that case, and of course we didn't and we don't sit on any cases, but had for some reason that case been delayed 3 years and was dismissed, then to bring that back would have involved bringing back those 40 witnesses, including that witness from California and that one from Helsinki, Finland, just to reindict the case. The Dash 13 amendment would alleviate the state of that duty by tying it to the already existing, already vetted statute of limitations on those types of cases. We've got another case pending in Multnomah County in front of the Multnomah County Grand Jury that's already heard from 150 witnesses. To say the state can simply refile on these, the most serious of charges, does a great disservice to the grand jurors that serve on grand jury, to the prosecutors that indict those cases, and also puts, quite frankly, form over substance. If it's a serious case, the state's going to reindict it, and it's going to reindict it within the statute of limitations. It's just going to be done. I'm afraid that I just haven't heard a good argument that counters the idea that tying these most serious of felonies to the statute of limitations is a good idea. I'm sure there's an argument out there, but I haven't been privy to that. Finally, I want to bring up one other very important point, and that's victims' rights. I know you heard when Mr. Taylor introduced this bill that the Dash 13 amendment addresses the victims' rights. I want to talk about just briefly what the Dash 13 amendment says, and where it would amend Section 3, which Mr. Knott brought up, and says that the court shall consider the interest and the statutory and constitutional rights of the victim, including those under Article 1, Section 42, and Section 43 of the Oregon Constitution, when deciding whether there are substantial and compelling reasons to allow the proceeding to continue. That's all it says. It incorporates the victim's rights, which are already constitutionally mandated, into the statutory speedy trial. Finally, I want to say on behalf of my organization that when we drafted the Dash 13 amendment, with the great help of Jessica Minifee, that shouldn't go unstated, that I was in consultation with Meg Garvin from the National Crime Victims Law Institute, and she said that she believes that the inclusion of the protection of victims' rights and interests, which the Dash 13 amendment does, is absolutely critical to the bill and to justice, and the aligning time periods to coincide with the statute of limitations ensures that it is also more in line with victims' rights and interests than the alternative on the table. Again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. House?
Mr. Taylor. I'm a little bit confused by the reference to the Constitution and victims' rights, because if a constitutional right exists here for victims, it doesn't really matter whether we put it in statute, because the Constitution trumps the statute. So are you trying to add something else to that particular provision?
No, sir, but I think that, pardon me, Chair Barker and Council Taylor, I think it's important to victims of crimes in the state and to people that litigate on behalf of them that be first and foremost, or at least close to the top in terms of priorities for a judge to consider. And it's in there to highlight the strong priority that the district attorney's offices in the state give to victims and victims' rights.
Mr. Chair, yes. So what you're saying is you're not trying to add anything that you think that's already there. Is that correct?
It's already there. That's correct, Council Taylor. But I think that what it would do in practical terms, if there were, according to subsection 4, a motion to dismiss, and the judge went back up to subsection 3, I could see that if the judge read the judge must consider the statutory and constitutional rights of the victim, that it would have an impact on the decision-making process by the judge at the trial court level.
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir, the question.
So who would be exercising that right on behalf of the victim, the district attorney?
If the victim requested that the district attorney, if the district attorney were to be the proponent of that victim's rights, then yes. But victims also quite often have attorneys of their own, and they would bring those issues themselves.
One further question, Mr. Chairman. If I'm correct, then the district attorney on his own can do that on behalf of the victim. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question clearly.
Am I correct in saying that the assistant district attorney, a district attorney on his or her own, could raise that issue in behalf of the victim?
I believe that's true, sir.
Thanks.
Yes.
And so on the same thread, though, by all means, you get back to me later on this if need be, but it seems like I say that to you a lot. But
every time I'm here,
I know you can handle these questions, though, is why I feel licensed for that. Okay, same. So I'm looking at page 2, lines 26 and 27. The court shall consider the interests and the statutory and constitutional rights of the victim, et cetera, et cetera. Do you know of anywhere else in the Oregon Revised Statutes where that kind of provision is included?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, not off the top of my head, but I will get back to you on that happily.
And the reason I ask, this may be a rather major policy question here, whether we are thinking of it in those terms or not. It may be something that hasn't really been done before, and I would submit requires a very careful prior analysis before we sort of jump in that direction. That's why I'm asking. So we can discuss that again later.
Chair Barker, may I make one comment in reference
please.
To that? And when I read the A engrossed 1550, what it doesn't ever talk about is a hearing or the form of a hearing that would occur on this motion to dismiss. Section 4 says that sections 1, 2, 3 shall apply to a proceeding in which a motion to dismiss is filed after. Section 3 just says if a trial is not commenced as required by Section 1 of this section, the court shall order the charging instrument to be dismissed. There's no discussion of the hearing, of the form of the hearing, of the timing of the hearing. And I would submit to this committee that should be of concern also. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Marquis.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Josh Marquis. 20 years ago today, I was appointed district attorney by Governor Barbara Roberts. And after some of my comments, I think I probably should say I'm speaking primarily for myself, although I think many of my prosecutor friends. I'm very concrete. I want to give you a couple really concrete examples. This is, with the exception of one very, very brief opportunity last week, this is a major bill. I think it is, as Representative Hicks says, major policy. I was a defense attorney for a couple of years. Delay only benefits one side. Delay benefits a defendant, no question about it. Cases don't get better from our side, they get worse. We have no incentive to draw things out. The metric, as I'm sure you're aware, that the state courts use of measuring their success is whether the cases are resolved. Generally speaking, both for victims, certainly, and for defendants, and for the community, is to get them resolved quicker. But as I understand why DOJ is supporting this bill. From their perspective, Aaron said, it's a real mess at the appellate level. But to be really blunt, when one of these cases gets dismissed, the victim is not going to call the Attorney General's office. They're going to call me, probably at my home number that's listed in the phone book, and asking why, when this guy has gone out and hid out for 4 years and managed to keep one step ahead of the cops, has this case been dismissed, and now it's beyond the statute of limitations. So, and I'm sure it was a slip, if a Freudian slip, when he said in the state of Portland. Outside of the state of Portland, where many of us practice, for example, as counsel has already pointed out, Mr. House, there is no hearing. The defendant is not given a trial date. They're not given a trial date till later. Let me give you a really concrete example. In my county, which is a beautiful place, and you all come visit, a lot of people do, most of them come and recreate and do nice things, a small tiny percentage do bad things. The joke among the local defense bar is, come on vacation, leave on probation. But first we have to convict them. But here's a typical example that would be a big problem. Guy comes here from either Portland or maybe worse from Seattle, or even worse from Madison, Wisconsin, and I'll get to that in a second. And he beats the living daylights out of his wife. He likes to beat up his wife. He has a previous conviction for beating up his wife, so now he has committed the felony of assault 4. Now, he is gone within 2 days. The Seaside Police Department gets a report. We put together a grand jury. We somehow get the victim maybe is in a women's shelter, or we get her testimony. We get the case indicted. That defendant is not arrested, does not appear in court, and let's assume he's in Portland or some other part of Oregon. We send a letter to his last known address. Doesn't respond. He's never appeared in court. He's not only not failed to appear for trial, he's never appeared in court at all. 4 years goes by because we all know that there aren't such things as warrant squads anymore. I know a couple of you on the committee were police officers. That's something that in the way far back mirror. That just doesn't exist. So that person's not going to get arrested. Let's take a less dramatic example. And by the way, what would happen if that guy was in Madison, Wisconsin? Well, that's a Class C felony, members of the committee, and the Oregon governor will not authorize extradition on Class C felonies outside of Shuttle. And the Oregon case law is that if the due diligence that Mr. Knott talked about was not exercised, then too bad. So I can put in all the requests I want to extradite this felony wife beater from Madison, Wisconsin. It's simply not going to happen. Another case.
Question.
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Marquis. So on page 2 of the bill,
yes,
right in the middle, lines 26 and 27, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that this bill, the statutory speedy trial, that time in which you could not locate him, either because he was actively avoiding apprehension or reasonable efforts would not count towards
this. Chair Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I'm so glad you asked me that question. Because because in the draft it says, as determined by due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck does that mean? Let me. I'll give you another concrete example. That person in Madison, Wisconsin, gets stopped by a Madison police officer on a speeding ticket, and so when finally we somehow by some miracle get him back 4 years later, and he says, "Well, wait a minute. 2 years after the indictment was issued, I was stopped by a police officer, an agent of the government, and you don't know about that, and you didn't follow up on that." And believe me, when I was a defense attorney for a couple of years, and I in a small enough county that I litigate motions for speedy trial. And frankly, I haven't thus far. I'm sure Gail Meyer is very has some wonderful horror stories to tell you, but about where constitutional speedy trial is inadequate. But I can tell you that in every experience I've had, where a case is 4 or 5 years old, and a defendant comes forward and says, "Let's say same thing. I was accused of beating my wife in a hotel room in Seaside," and he says, "Well, my friends were in the room right next door, but 4 years have gone by, and they've split up, and I think she moved to Canada, and I have no way of locating her." Boom, the burden just shifts to the prosecution. We lose, case is dismissed. Very briefly, because I know you, and I really appreciate Chair Barker giving us time to address these issues. Let's just take just a seventh DUII, and these are not that rare. Not close enough to make it a felony, let's say, but the person is just basically a career drunk driver. If he is able, as one of the DAs said, to get rewarded for his bad behavior by running far enough away, or just keeping low enough profile not to get arrested, 2 years and one day after his seventh DUI, he's home free. Because, as Jeff said, a misdemeanor cannot be recharged, or most misdemeanors cannot be recharged, more than 2 years later. And again, unless we've shown due diligence. You know, in many cases, re-indictment is not practical. And this is a mechanism, I don't think, to regulate cases. I think this is a mechanism to simply dismiss cases. And I think, I know this is on a fast track. I know it passed the House, the Senate 28-2, and the dissents were about what they considered an expansion of the death penalty, which I completely disagree with. But I would just ask you to seriously consider why it is that the district attorneys of this state feel so strongly about something when an old case is generally a bad case for us. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Hicks?
So thank you for participating in this process throughout. I do want to acknowledge that. And because ODAA has participated in this process, you know what a long, strange trip it's been to get us here. So this, for my part, the work I've done on this, it's been very difficult. But I've ultimately defaulted to what I consider to be the original intent behind the speedy trial statute, which historically seems to have been as a housekeeping measure for the courts. And so there is always going to be something disadvantageous to either side, both the defense and to the state, in a speedy trial statute. And so neither side is going to be entirely happy. But I think ultimately this bill is the best one to accomplish the original intent of a speedy trial statute. And so there are things in here that are disadvantageous to the state, yes. There are things in here that are disadvantageous to the defense. However, if we're trying to make it a housekeeping measure for the courts, something that's functional in that respect, I think this is a good bill.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this following up, I suppose, for purpose of legislative history, on my question and answer with Mr. Marquis, I read the statute differently. I do not believe that that a defendant who is actively trying to avoid apprehension at that time will count towards this. Now, I do concede that due diligence is potentially vague there in that statute. And I would be very disappointed indeed if any judge used this statute or this legislative history to essentially reward a defendant for actively avoiding law enforcement. And should that motion ever present itself, I think hopefully my statement will make for persuasive legislative history. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Just by Steve Dole.
Mr. Chair. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United is opposed to Senate Bill 1550A. Just again, from a process standpoint, we were not asked to or included in on a work group when it came to this bill. And I would submit to you that victims have a stake in this issue. It was brought forward by Deputy District Attorney Howes about the issue of the crimes that we're talking about here. And as he said, as stated, there's 182 crimes in the sentencing guidelines grid. And I think he also stated that there were about 40 of these crimes that we were actually talking about when it came to the application of statute of limitations. But what I'd ask you to consider further is just the humanity of this. And the humanity of it is this, that most of those crimes are sex crimes. And if you look at most of those crimes, they're crimes against children. So what are you really saying to these children and their parents? That this is just a ministerial process, that we just check a box and we dismiss and we reindict? What does that mean to the victim? You know what it means? It means you have to take your child and you have to go through that indictment again and through that grand jury process, and that you have to appear in front of seven strangers and relive that one more time. So it's not that simple, ladies and gentlemen. It's not that simple, representatives. As Mr. Howes said, easier said than done. Well, I got to tell you something. It's not so easy on the victims. And again, we're talking about children here in most cases. You all have children. You know what I'm talking about. The other issue is this, and it has to do with the victim's rights. Victims under the Constitution and under ORS 147.500 have a right right now when a charge is amended, dismissed, or set aside to be notified, to be heard, or to appear and to be heard. If judges are doing this with just, again, through a paper process, how does the victim exercise their right? And I think you may have a constitutional question with that. And I would remind you that in Oregon, up till 2008, when this legislative body was good enough to refer it to the people, our victims' rights were just pretty paper. But they're no longer pretty paper. They're actionable. When a right's violated, the victim can get an attorney and seek judicial resolution. So those are the reasons that we oppose it. On its face, we think it's a pretty good bill, but the timelines are wrong. They should be set with statute of limitations, and there is this question in Section 3 about the victim's rights.
I would just say I thought about this as I do this. What's coming up over the weekend, and I was thinking about some little girl having to go back to a different grand jury to a point where she might say, "Please, please don't make me," and people would give up, and the perpetrator would walk scot-free. I'm gravely concerned about that. But I'd like to ask you and also the district attorneys to do, since we plan to move this bill forward, is to keep track of any incidents like this so we can have some concrete issues. And we would certainly, I believe, be ready to revisit in the 15th session if we see that we're having problems along those lines. I know even one case is a huge problem, but I would ask that you have any documentation you can bring back to us.
Well, I will say this. This is just the world we live in. That and we thank the legislature for referring the constitutional amendments to the people, and we thank the people, of course, for overwhelmingly voting on making victims' rights actionable. But as a result of that, myself and three other people formed the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center. Hardy Myers is the president, I'm the vice president, and you can be sure that we're going to look for when victims' rights are violated here if they're not notified and able to speak and able to be present. when these charges are amended, dismissed, or set aside.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your work.
Do I have a moment to speak to the Dash 10? I'd also like to just take a moment and speak to the Dash 10 amendments, which were amendments that were brought forward by Crime Victims United of Oregon and also were supported by the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. And this had to do with House Bill 2549 that was passed in the 2013 session. And I don't mean to sound like I'm whining here because I'm not. I just want to point it out. Crime Victims United has been part of many, many work groups in the past, particularly when it came to the issue of sex offender registration, but we were not asked to participate in the work group that put together 2549. Now, did we support the basic concept? Yes. This might surprise a lot of people in the room, may surprise some on the committee. We thought that in many cases, sex offender registration was onerous in the state of Oregon. And we didn't believe that everybody that had committed a sex offense should have to struggle under lifetime registration. But like in everything, when it comes to crime, there's degrees. And certainly if some 20-year-old was stupid enough to have sex with a 13-year-old girl, it's a crime in this state, and it's stupid. But should they have to live under a lifetime registration? No. So we congratulate the fact that we made a better law here. But just like the pendulum had swung too far one way in putting everybody under lifetime registration, it swung a little too far this way on who we took off of the requirement for lifetime registration. And what I would submit to you and what we asked for in this amendment was very simple. This amendment isn't something that takes a work group to develop. It's very simple. We ask that attempted rape, attempted sodomy, attempted unlawful penetration, and sex abuse in the first degree be put back in to lifetime registration without relief. Now, let me tell you the reasons real quickly. Any or most DAs, and I'm sure you could call any one of that are in the room today to attest to this, that they don't charge attempts when it comes to these first-degree sex crimes. These are fallback positions for them in plea negotiations. So if you have a rape in the first degree or a sodomy in the first degree or an unlawful penetration in the first degree, and I have to tell you, in most of these cases, it isn't an evidentiary problem. It's a victim problem, if you will. You have a child that somebody doesn't want to put on the stand. You have a woman who is scared to death of her perpetrator, or you have a patient that's incapacitated because of physical or mental situations that you can't get to the stand. So in a lot of sex cases, there's a problem because of the victim. So what do? We have this fallback situation, but what are we saying with 2549? We know you committed a rape. We know you committed a sodomy. But we have to fall back to this attempt. And furthermore, we're saying, even though we know you did this, we're going to give you the ability in the state of Oregon, because of House Bill 2549, to come off of lifetime registration, even though we know you're a rapist. Now, let me fall back to sex abuse in the first degree for a moment. Sex abuse in the first degree is just legal terminology for child molester. That's what the people out there know it is. And likewise, it's used as a fallback under some cases for a plea negotiation from the first degree sex crimes. But sex abuse in the first degree are crimes against children. Can they be committed against an adult? Yes, when there's a forcible situation. But most of these crimes, the vast majority, are crimes against children who are under the age of 14. So what is 2549 saying to the people of Oregon? You're a child molester, and we're not going to keep you on lifetime registration. Now, somebody said to me, well, you know what? We have this process, so we've got this tiered system, and if they have an attempt and they were convicted of it, that's something that they'll look at. Well, one other thing that 2549 did and that I will remind you about is this. Now, I'm not necessarily looking for a change here, but this is the one other part we weren't too happy with. You took this away from judges to make the decision on. You took it out of the hands of judges who are elected officials, who have accountability to the people, and you put it in the hands of bureaucrats. So if somebody takes a person that we know raped an 8-year-old little girl and lets them off just because they're now in the attempt column somewhere down the line, who's going to do anything about that? Who gets held accountable? Who gets held accountable? So I think, with all due respect, it was a very simple, common sense change to the pendulum just swinging too far the other way by 4 crimes. And I'm very, very disappointed and sorry to hear that we're not going to take this up and vote on it and get it fixed, because the people out there, I think, will also be very sorry to hear that we're saying you're a child molester and we're not going to keep you on lifetime registration. And I'd be happy to take any questions or answer any questions.
Thank you. And you know, this is certainly an issue. We, you know, I've had a work group trying to figure out how to rank people so we get the dangerous, so we keep the dangerous people listed. And the things you've talked about are something we will certainly be continue to look into.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Ms. Myers, do you want to come up and say a few words? Emphasize a few. Yeah.
Chair members of the committee, the issue was raised about due diligence. I just did a search of the Oregon case law. It's mentioned in 538 cases in Oregon law, so it's a term the courts are very familiar with.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm only going to address my comments to the -A11 and A13 amendment, which relates to statutory speedy trial. I'll leave it up to the chair if you'd like to ask anything other than that. I just want to set the record straight. We really did reach out to the District Attorneys Association and the victims community. And when I say we, I mean it was the people who were at the table, which was the Department of Justice and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The Judicial Department was there in a silent role, but they were there. At no time did the district attorneys put a proposal on the table. At no time did they offer a proposal. The feedback we got from them was they preferred straight-out repeal, which was going to take an effect in April, and they were going to wait and see what we produced. And there were times when we did meet with Ms. Vittelins and had discussions, but at no time were they a proactive participant in finding a new codification. Similarly, we, meaning myself and Lane Borg, the president of OCDLA, we made a phone call to Meg Garvin, a victim advocate with the National Crime Victims Law Institute. We asked her specifically, would you please help us and participate? The comment we got was, definitely, if the defendant can't get in through the door and get to a speedy trial, neither can the victim. So to some extent, that the victim's interests and the defendant's interests are aligned in terms of having a speedy trial. But ultimately, the feedback we got from Ms. Garvin was, we're just not interested in something that has as its remedy is a dismissal. So they just didn't really know how to engage or how to participate. But that outreach was given. And I did have a lengthy discussion with Mr. Dole midway through the negotiations. The only other comment I want to make is that both the Department of Justice and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association separately and collaboratively did a 49-state review of the other 49 states. This is my very dog-eared copy. We went through this at length. I don't know if the district attorneys have seen this, but I can say that the suggestions and the comments and the amendments that they're trying to proffer in their A11 and A13 is so far outside the range of normal of anything you see in the other states, it makes me wonder if they've taken a look at it. There is the 2- and 3-year time frame that we elected to use in 1558 is as long as any codified in any other state. There is no any other state that imports an extended statute of limitation period for murder or sex crimes or others and imports them into the statutory speedy trial as the time frame to trial. Think what they're saying. In a murder case, You have for the lifetime of the defendant to bring the case to trial. That's what the importation of the statute of limitations does. It almost renders the statute a joke. Similarly, if you were to embrace the three parts of their proposal and add them all together, you would have a statute with absolutely no teeth whatsoever. The district attorney proposal is to have the whole time frame start from the day of arraignment, so the defendant is now appointed with counsel or has counsel and they're going through the door. But they also want to exclude judicial delay. And they also want to extend it for the limitation period. And all the delay is excluded if it's caused by the defendant, and all delay is excluded if it goes up on appeal. And so if you start it from a day of arraignment and exclude judicial delay and have your extended limitation period, you essentially don't have a statute with any teeth. And what's been put into the 1550A is very much, I would agree with Mr. Knott's characterization, it's on the prosecution-friendly side of what is the norm in the other states. But I do assure the committee that what's being proffered by the district attorneys and their amendments is very much outside anything the range of normal that you'll see elsewhere.
One of the issues, thank you very much for your testimony, was this bill is a gutting stuff from the Senate side. The Senate then tells people you can fix it on this side. We're in a short session, and it's very difficult. And I've seen this isn't the only bill that's a problem, a policy bill that's coming, you know, really late. We don't have any time to really consider these additional things. And so on this bill, we're not. We're going to go ahead and move this one out. But I have a philosophical problem with the way we're doing the short session this time. I've already spoken to my leadership, and I'm planning next session to introduce a bill that says in the short session that we will discuss the budgetary items and try to correct those, and any policy would require a three-fifths vote of the members, so we don't have political issues being bounced around unnecessarily in the short session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I co-sponsor that bill, please?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's going anywhere, but yes.
If you recall, back in the old days when the Republicans had control, we suggested a filter where you had two Republicans and two Democrats would look at these bills during the special, and nothing would come forward without unanimous consent. So you've got to have what you're talking about or some process that this thing just doesn't keep expanding and political motivations get into it. Yep. It doesn't help us as a legislature, the way we look, doing things in this manner.
And we're not through seeing the political machinations of this 35-day session just yet. Yes, Mr. Cameron.
Yeah, your suggestion was an amendment that I had for the constitutional referral to the people that the former Speaker of the House, that you know really well, wouldn't allow to go through. But that's exactly what the amendment suggested was financial.
With Representative Richardson as well.
Three-fifths majority on any policy issues. So this is a great example of a short session and trying to do work that is just almost impossible to get right.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 1550A. I expect to have a work session to move it out tomorrow. Any further business to come before the committee? No. We are adjourned.
It hasn't been easy.